David A. Price presents...
Hey, Shellheads! Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 317. I'm your golden armored host, Steve Raker, repulsing you from the bowels of the comic book bunker, where this episode we have for you a look back at the 1991 Dragon Seed arc from Iron Man 270 to 275 with Andrew and Kevin, which spirals into a discussion of the new Tony Stark Iron Man title, written by Dan Slott, as well as the first issues of the relaunch title he last worked on, The Amazing Spider-Man, now helmed by Nick Spencer. And some Marvel Rising talk in there, too, if I'm not mistaken. Marvel Noise is proudly sponsored by Nobody, and happy to be part of the exclusive club that is the Deliberate Noise Network, which features other fine shows such as Comic Book Noise, DC Noise, and our sister show, Indie Comic Book Noise. You can find episodes of Marvel Noise past and present over on marvelnoise.com and reach us on Facebook and Twitter at Marvel Noise. Item, don't forget to make your plans to attend the Baltimore Comic Con, September 28th to September 30th, 2018. It's at the Baltimore Convention Center, right there in the tourist trap that is the Inner Harbor. I'll be there and hope you will be too. Get your details at baltimorecomiccon.com. I'll have a con report from my upcoming trip to the Boston Comic Con next episode. Before I get the guys on, though, let me give you the skinny on this recent Hunt for Wolverine event and the associated titles. Wolverine's back, right? I mean, we've seen him in these one-page cameos in the back of the new books in past months. He's looking good, you know, in the cowboy hat. He's got the sideburns and everything going on. This Hunt for Wolverine, though, it's less about Logan coming back and more about his peers in the Marvel Universe learning that he's back and going out looking for him. In the Hunt for Wolverine one-shot, that was, I mean, all this is spring into summer 2018, in case you're listening to this some many years in the future via the archive on marvelnoise.com. It's real convenient. Over in the right-hand column, you'll see a little calendar drop-down menu. You can go to any month of any year that the show's been around from the 10-year-plus history of the show. But this Hunt for Wolverine one-shot this past spring had two stories in it. One was Secrets and Lies, with art by David Marquez, and the other, Hunter's Pride, spelt like Kitty Pride, with art by Paolo Sequeira and Walden Wong, both written by Charles Soule. In these tales, we revisit Wolverine's adamantium mummification some months, more than a year back at this point, and learn that afterwards, Kitty actually phased his corpse from its adamantium shell. The cracked open shell that we've seen glimpses of in recent months, it's because the Reavers attacked its location and cracked it open, not that Logan, like, cut or bust his way out somehow. So the X-Men bury Wolverine, but surprise, the corpse goes missing. Logan's out there somewhere, and the X-Men and friends, like Tony Stark and Matt Murdock, are searching for him. And that launches four limited series, all with covers by Greg Land, with the Hunt for Wolverine in the title. There was Hunt for Wolverine, The Adamantium Agenda. This was written by Tom Taylor with art by R.B. Silva and Adriana Benedetto. This is actually a return of the New Avengers. It's a reunion of sorts. Iron Man, Spider-Man, Luke Cage, and Jessica Jones. They all get together. They go on a lead where they are thinking that Wolverine's corpse could be weaponized, and they go undercover to participate in an underground auction that's not underground, it's actually underwater, it's on a sub, it's underground because it's, you know, not above ground. You understand what I'm saying here? This is getting to be like a who's on first thing. But there is a auction for superpowered DNA, and they think it might be Wolverine's. But when they get there, undercover, underwater, you follow me now, It's not Wolverine's DNA. It's actually Luke and Jessica's baby's DNA. So that freaks them out, and appropriate hijinks ensue. And of course, where there's DNA being marketed in the Marvel Universe, Mr. Sinister can't be far. There was also Hunt for Wolverine, Mystery in Madripoor, written by Jim Zub, with art by Tony Silas. A contingent of X-Men, Psylocke, Kitty, Jubilee, Storm, Rogue, and Domino, all of Logan's girls, they all take a girl's trip to Magneto-controlled Madripoor to look for Logan there. This gives readers a chance to see what the current status quo in Madripoor is, just in time for its apple cart to get upset with our ex-BFF girlfriends caught in the middle. Hunt for Wolverine, The Claws of a Killer, written by Mariko, I kid you not, Tamaki, with art for the most part by Butch Geis and Cam Smith, we have Wolvie's son, Dokken, Sabretooth, and Lady Deathstrike forming an uneasy, to say the least, alliance to find the missing Logan and make sure he's dead. And if he isn't, they're going to make sure he is going forward. Catch my drift? They follow a lead to a remote town that's been taken over by zombies. What? Crazy, right? Then there's Hunt for Wolverine, Weapon Lost, written by Charles Soule, with art by Matteo Bafongi. In the Hunt for Wolverine one-shot, Kitty had asked Daredevil to search for Logan's missing body, and this series follows Daredevil's efforts. He recruits Misty Knight, an Inhuman detective named Frank McGee, and Doug Ramsey, Cypher from the old New Mutants title. They might not find Wolverine, but they do flush out the cyborgy Albert from the old Larry Hama, Mark Silvestri, Dan Green run on Wolverine. So that's the deal with the Hunt for Wolverine. It's okay overall, with the best of the bunch being the Adamantium Agenda, the New Avengers reunion one. With Wolverine proper coming back, Old Man Logan is starting to sound pretty redundant. Yet during this Marvel Legacy era on the Old Man Logan title, writer Ed Brisson is serving up some good stories. The last three completed arcs begin with Moving Target in issues 36 through 38, and find Old Man Logan crossing paths with a dude who has a USB drive with the goods on Wilson Fisk, who's currently the mayor of New York, and of course the kingpin of crime. The guy is killed in Logan's presence, so he's roped into protecting the encrypted drive, but Kingpin sends Bullseye after it, with the art by Dalibor Talajic. Issue 39 to 40 has the parody title Glob Loves, Man Kills, and it's a Wolverine and the X-Men type tale of the students at Xavier's Institute. The transparent Glob goes on a date from an online mutant dating site, but it's a trap. It's the Purifiers, and they raid the X-Mansion, and Old Man Logan helps the kids defend it and learn valuable lessons along the way, with art by Ibrahim Robertson. Old Man Logan 41 and 42 are the two-part Logan the Hunted, with art by Francesco Manna. Kraven the Hunter captures Old Man Logan and then drops him in the Savage Land with a four-hour cushion, then comes a hunting for him. And then the current arc that begins in issue 43 is Bullseye Returns. This arc is sick so far. It's a great Wolverine story, Old Man Logan or not. I encourage you to check out the Ed Brisson issues of Old Man Logan. You won't be sorry. And now for something completely different. All right, as promised, I've got Andrew the LA Rabbit and WWX Kevin on board to talk about an old Iron Man run. Well, it's old now, but it still doesn't seem like an old book to me because it's from the 90s. But I've been barking up your guys' tree for the better part of a year to say, you know what arc I really would like to reread? I'd like to reread Iron Man 270 to 275 from the summer of 1991 that had the Mandarin and Fin Fang Foom in it.
That's crazy that this is a 90s. Like, it doesn't seem... like, it's my era of comics where, like, everything seems recognizable, but it's not, like, the extreme 90s.
No, not enough pouches, I would say. The Fim Fang Foom should have had like a jacket with shoulder pads and everything.
Exactly.
A flak jacket. No, it's only summer 1991. And the Dragon Seed saga here from Iron Man 270 to 275, the creative team we have is Paul Ryan on pencils and Bob Wycheck on inks and John Byrne writing, yeah, and getting third billing throughout the run.
Oh, and we have one little fill-in issue, though, Steve.
Right. Well, Byrne also, he's a humble man, you know. That he's always known to be humble. Yeah, M.D. Bright, Mark Bright, draws issue 275. So the story begins in issue 270 with Tony Stark landing his jet in Beijing, China. And he's got Iron Man in tow with James Rhodes, Rhodey, in the armor. Now, at this time, Rhodey, he's already been War Machine and all that, but he's just helping Tony out on this mission and playing the role of the trusted bodyguard, which is who the world thinks Iron Man is. They don't know Iron Man and Tony Stark are one and the same.
I think what also might have thrown Kevin off is this is not a very 90s Iron Man. Like, it's very clean and not a lot of little fidgets and doodads and ridges and things like that. Like, it's a very simple streamline.
Yeah, I think it reminds me more of Bronze Age Iron Man.
Ditto. Tony also, I mean, he's decades now from needing the Iron Man suit to keep shrapnel from reaching his heart and all that, right? But
wait, what, Steve?
During this tale, he has survived a gunshot assassination attempt by the evil Eminem Mars twins. All right, maybe it's just the Mars twins. But do you remember them from Byrne's? They were introduced in Byrne's Namor run as the evil corporate espionage types. And so now that Byrne is writing, even though it's getting third billing, Byrne's writing Iron Man, so he does the corporate angle of the Mars Corporation trying to take over Stark and all that stuff. And there's an assassination attempt. He gets Barbara Gordon'd in the spine, and the gunshot leaves him wheelchair-bound. But Tony whips up a suit of, like, neural netting that keeps him upright and running around and stuff.
Well, that was so creepy because I didn't realize, like, I've read various issues where, like, he's wounded or there's something wrong with him. And, like, he guest appears and you're like, oh, this is his wheelchair era or whatever. And here it's like he has that creepy skin on top of a skin that he can just sort of unzip or rip off. And it looks like he's taking his outer skin off. It's just very weird.
So then that's not enough of a crutch. Now the problem is that this neural net is eating away his nervous system, and he's just not gotten much more time to live. He's in a degenerating condition, rapidly. So that's why Tony's in China, to meet with a renowned female neurobiologist, Dr. Su Yin, who, unknown to Tony, the Chi-Coms have all kinds of hooks in.
Yeah, in her introduction, they keep her face obscured. I thought it was going to be like Madame Mask or some kind of
right?
reveal, because they play it very like we're supposed to know her or something. And so when they reveal it, I was like, oh, it's no one I reckon. I thought it was going to be some remember her from issue 172 or whatever.
No, they're doing a Mary Jane Watson, basically. You know, you don't know what she looks like. She's in shadows. You only see her from behind, and then all of a sudden you see her, and up, she's a babe. So meanwhile, Iron Man's arch-villain, the Mandarin, detects Tony's arrival in China. He has one of those, like, feels a disturbance in the force kind of thing.
When did he take over a third of China, though?
This has been building in the previous issues, along with Tony's regression and his, like I said, degeneration. We've also seen the Mandarin rising, thanks to his trusty mentor that he's got, feeding him advice. But the Mandarin's all set up in a mountain airy like palace with, like I said, the spiritual advisor, the elderly pipe smoking and often levitating Chen Su,
Well, I enjoyed this series a lot. The portrayal of the Chinese is not the most sophisticated, I'll say. And some of the art artifacts I thought were interesting. I'm reading this on the Marvel Unlimited. So the translation of the tone patterns makes it look, when we're introduced to the levitating master, it almost looks in some scenes like he's wearing fishnet stockings.
Yeah.
Because he's wearing like a almost flesh colored pants with a cross hatching. Like, who is he going for, the Typhoid Mary look? But, you know, that's just a fun artifact of the translation. But yeah, there's going to be lots of like Confucius type proclamations and phrases like, likewise, I can coo like a turtle dove. Just things that seem, make me laugh a little bit. But nonetheless, I do enjoy how they portray Iron Man. A lot of times they have him in the air, but moving vertically, which I think looks cool.
Yeah.
And kind of badass.
Definitely. I really like Paul Ryan. Overall, I don't think there's been a title that I didn't enjoy Paul Ryan's art on. Shame he passed away last year, I believe, right? Well, the Mandarin with Chen Tzu leading him, or advising him, like you said, Kevin, he's ruling a third of China, but they want the world. And they've got the early Marvel era monster Fin Fang Foom napping in the yard like a guard dog.
I thought he was meditating.
There's a state dinner in Beijing to introduce Stark to Dr. Yin, who, as we said before, is a babe. The Chi-Coms want a favor in exchange for her services. And it's an Iron Man favor. I love it. There's a scene in the hotel where Rhodey's pulling off the fake skin he had over his face from the dinner, and Tony's pulling off the fake skin from his chest. It's just a couple of dudes shedding their skin off fake skin. I hate to be the maid who comes in there and is like, what happened in here?
Well, also, like, immediately upon meeting the doctor, Tony starts hitting on her, like, right away.
Well, that's why they...
Gotta keep your priorities.
That's why they kept the babe thing a secret, so it was all of a sudden it would be, like, full throttle as soon as you see her face. Tony's getting ready in the hotel room there to head out as Iron Man to meet whatever obligation, or at least see what the deal is with this, you know, favor for the Chi-Coms. But Rhodey gasses him and takes his place. And remember what we were saying about the Mandarin controlling a third of China? Well, that's the problem the Chi-Coms want Iron Man to take on.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, well, also remember that thing about Fin Fang Foom being like the Mandarin's guard dog? Well, issue 271 is an all-out brawl between Iron Man and the Jolly Green Winged Giant.
I really like that they just jump right into that. I mean, they do give a slight recap if you missed the last issue, but they don't futz around with like, oh, he's going to figure out where he is. Or like, I just like to just cut right to the fight. Like, yeah, I'm all on board with that. I was a little worried. Sometimes with these things, you know, they want to show every panel and everything. And I highly compliment them on just cutting right to it.
There's not a lot of places you can hide a Fin Fang Foom, so...
Well, I admit I might first look in the Valley of the Dragons. I mean, it's just like, it's probably where I would go. But I do like the, like you say, the art team is having fun with this battle, and Iron Man has lots of gizmos.
But for the most part, Fin Fang Foom is really like, he's mopping the floor with Rhodey. Gizmos be damned.
Well, he misses the big shoulder cannon.
Yeah, crutch. Meanwhile, Tony meets with Dr. Yin, and they're like running a battery of medical tests and stuff. And also Chen Tzu, the Mandarin's aged mentor, his aged Genghis, if you will, is revealed to have this ulterior motive for advising the Mandarin, and he begins to enact his secret plan, contacting these well-established Chinamen around the country.
Who are immortal, or at least very, very long lived.
Yeah, they're talking about all. They're talking about it's time, and referring to people as mortals, and that they've grown comfortable in these bodies and all that stuff. Issue 272 begins with the tale of a long-ago spaceship crash on Earth in China.
What?
This vessel, piloted by humanoid dragon men, who used rings to power and control their ship...
That seems awfully suspicious, Steve.
They crash into a mountain. The ship is trapped. They, as ceremony and ritual would demand, they leave their rings on the control panel dais. That way, if something happens to them, one of them at least could come back and pilot the ship on his own with all of the rings. So the crew head out to explore, but it's a barbaric world. A few of them are slain, and the rest of them are forced to assimilate and even eventually take on human form.
Wait, they can shapeshift?
Hey, you make do when your back's against the wall. You'd be surprised with untapped avenues of skills you have.
Oh, that maybe you can shrink, too, and become a cook.
Back in the present, Chen Su is
It would actually be his real size if they were all started out as, like, humanoid-sized.
But they talk about how they've grown over time, like evolved and grown, so that the rings don't even fit them anymore, unless they're in a human form. But in the present, Chen Su is now telepathically communicating with Fin Fang Foom, calling him Navigator, and Foom calling Su Captain. I mean, Burn, if you haven't figured it out yet, Burn is cleverly tied together in, I think, the best Roy Thomas fashion, the origins of Fin Fang Foom from Strange Tales 89 in 1961, and the origin of the Mandarin from Tales of Suspense 62 in 1964.
What's the best, though, is when the Mandarin discovers that alien ship, and his face is just like, what?
Yeah, I mean, have you read the original in Tales of Suspense to see what he's like? It's pretty good. Even at that time, on the opening panel, because I had to go back and look at Tales of Suspense 62 and see how much of this stuff was carried over and how much Byrne was adding to it. And right from the Mandarin had already appeared in earlier issues, and they wrote on the splash page, after receiving 500 requests... We, you know, feel compelled to present the origin of the Mandarin. And sure enough, he goes into the Valley of the Spirits and into the mountain and finds the dragon, the bones of a dragon-like alien, and gets onto the ship and finds the ship's log of the captain and finds the rings. And as it's telling about the cult, they're dragon people. So this all totally works, except for in Invincible Iron Man Annual 1, Matt Fraction, he retconned the Mandarin's origin, but forget about that. But so it's like Fin Fang Foom was one of the crew of the ship who the Mandarin's rings are found on. How brilliant is that?
You know, it's not related to our story, but I made note of all the time, is this Black Widow subplot where she wears all these different clothing, and it somehow she puts her clothing into like a type of her costume. Like she's wearing her costume, but it looks like it's just hilarious that all of her fashions are like still like her costume.
Yeah, you gotta have the little widow emblem on all your stuff. But I actually thought that was so interesting. I went and read on after to find out what the next plot line. I love when they seed the stories into the existing one. It makes it fun. So, but Tony is also on the full court press on the Doctor too. Like, dude, maybe you should worry about getting healed before you worry about, you know, getting your groove on.
Yeah, he's not getting anywhere with a cure or with Dr. Yin, but he keeps plugging away. The other thing about this Fin Fang Foom origin tie into the Mandarin and just connecting those two dots is that Foom really hadn't been used much at all by 1991 time. There was a big appearance because Simonson wanted to draw him in Thor 379 in 1986 6 or 7, something like that. But that ended up being Thor fighting Fin Fang Foom for an issue, and then, like, the Fin Fang Foom form gets shed, and it's really, haha, the Midgard Serpent in disguise. And then it goes on to be a Midgard Serpent versus Thor thing. So that really wasn't even Foom. So there was, I mean, no one had touched him. No one had done this. This was, I love Fin Fang Foom, so I really appreciate this storyline, just for that cool nostalgic tying in those old continuities. Very cool.
I like the super elongated neck, I think, was a real nice touch. Like, kind of different from your traditional dragon, I feel like. Doesn't, like, he has a really crazy long. I think that lets him put him in interesting positions and everything.
So the Chi-Coms are mad and interrupt Stark's treatment to show him satellite images of Iron Man's defeat at Fing Fang Foom's sizable hands. So Stark goes and he puts on a remote headset to control a pilotless suit of armor to join into the fray.
Isn't this like that? Oh no, it's like the Marvel Legends. I was thinking one of them had that attachment onto the back. But I think that was a Silver Centurion.
Like a little extra booster rocket.
Yeah.
Issue 273 starts out with Chen Su's crew revealing their true forms as dragons all over China as they heed Su's telepathic summons.
Whoa, it's like the Terrigen Mist or something. Everyone's just breaking out all of a sudden.
It's been centuries since they've seen each other, Kevin. They're flying around in formation. They're picking off livestock. This is great. Spreading their wings, quite literally.
Also, this whole time, Rhodey does the whole, you know, hero on the ropes who's just about dead, but when, for story reasons, he needs to have a little bit of energy, he's able to, but then he's back hurt again. I always like that when, like, I'm just about dead. Oh, but I can do this, and then he gets hit again. Oh, I'm just about dead, and then I can do this.
Tony, overall, though, he's faring way better than Rhodey versus Fin Fang Foom. He even temporarily takes out Foom with the old boost my repulsor rays with, like, the electric cables from the ground trick, you know? That's as old as this Iron Man comic.
But the problem is, Steve, he's got a lag. The servers are slow.
Yep. And the other problem is that once, even with Foom momentarily out of the picture, he's got the Mandarin to contend with, and the Mandarin just animates an entire mountain and crushes Iron Man with it, and by the time he blasts his way out, Foom is up and running again, so it's like, what are you going to do, you know? So he takes the armor and flees, much to the Mandarin's, glee. The Mandarin's celebrating his victory, standing over the defeated Rhodey, who's still laying there. And then all of a sudden, all the dragons show up. It's like 7 more Fin Fang Fooms. I mean, how fun is this, right? Lots of Fin Fang Fooms.
The other ones don't have the crazy neck.
There's all kinds of dragons. You got to give Foom his, his signature silhouette.
And I thought Bright did a really good job sort of integrating the feel and the look, because I'm reading these all in order and I feel like it's a nice handoff.
Yeah, 271 is the guest pencils by MD Bright, and I think he had his own run on the title in the mid to late 80s, if I'm not mistaken. So the drawn Iron Man's familiar.
And, right, but he's got to draw an awful lot of dragons.
This is true. And excited ones at that. Fin Fang Foom is all, the dragons, the hour of the gathering has come at last. You know, let me dance a jig and everything. And then even Chen Su himself transforms into, of course, a bearded dragon. He's the captain. Rhodey's.
I like when they transform back to human, they're all in the same outfit.
Rhodey's still on the ground, rolling around defeated and all scuffed up and everything like that, but he is able to start the psyops of chiding the Mandarin. Guess you're not in charge here, Mandy, you know? I bet you feel like a chump and all that. Then the Mandarin recalls his origin of finding the ship and the rings on the dais and all that. And as you said, Andrew, Chen Su and the dragons, they resume their human form, but it's because, you know, it's not just to make them more relatable to the Mandarin and Rhodey there and talking to them in the scene, but they say it's because the rings no longer fit their big dragon forms. They have to be human so that the rings will fit. And speaking of the rings, we now want them back. The Mandarin resists and he's fighting back, but they have like telepathic and telekinetic control over the rings, so they're just like pulling at them, and the Mandarin's arms are at arm's length, and I'm thinking his fingers are going to come off if this keeps up.
Yeah.
Oh, that'll never happen, Steve.
No. I kind of knew the name of A Future Story, but I was like, And then something will eventually happen here.
Tony, meanwhile, he's finally getting under Dr. Yin's skin. After a kiss, she says she loves him. Again, you don't know because her government's also telling her to lead him on, but she also loves her husband. Bum, bum, bum.
Uh-oh.
Grandma. This seemed like the most wafer-thin love story I've ever.
But Tony's got to, 275 is coming up. There's only pages left, so the issue ends with Tony's return to the battlefield in another suit, in person this time. So that giant-sized issue 275, which cost a whole $1.50, although it was $1.80 Canadian, Kevin.
Whoa.
Opens with Rhodey watching his boss fighting off a gaggle of fin-fang-foom-sized dragons.
Dragon Doom.
He manages for about 12 pages or so of just all-out battle. He even rides fin-fang-foom momentarily like a cowboy. But the Mandarin all this time has been in, like, silent shock. You know, he's recalling seeking one of his stolen rings from Chen Su's pawn shop in San Francisco's Chinatown and meeting him, and then Chen Su leading him on the quest to the Valley of, now the Valley of Dragons, not the Valley of Mists, to, or Spirits or whatever it was, to revive Fin Fang Foom, and then Fin Fang Foom becoming his mightiest weapon, and taking over a third of China and everything, and he realizes all the time he was a chump. So he finally acts, joining his greatest foe back-to-back fighting the dragons.
And remember now, he has unlocked the ring, so he's even more devastating than normal. Because they made a whole point that he was not able to fully integrate with the rings, so he's more hardcore.
More hardcore, but Chen Su still can laugh at him. You haven't the power. You've unlocked the power, but you haven't the power to command these rings. And Tony thinks, power? I got power. So he links hands with the Mandarin and funnels the suit's power into the rings, and boom.
Is that how this works? I thought that was a little weird, but, you know.
Really weird.
I think you mean Steve. Fin Fang Boom.
Yeah. So, Kevin, how cool were the reactions across the Marvel universe of the boom?
I know, I always like those things, right? Where you check in on the Marvel universe and they're like, something big's happening somewhere else.
Reed Richards is looking at his panel, warning, and Spider-Man wakes up out of bed with his spidey sense tingling, and Thor has like a Heimdall moment of detecting a disturbance in the Force, and even Man-Thing like flicks a bug off his shoulder.
It's like Thor chokes up on that hammer pretty high. Like, you think you'd handle it down by the handle because it's so short.
That's Eric Masterson, Thor. He doesn't know what he's doing. So when the snowy winds clear, the dragons and the Mandarin are gone, and Tony and Rhodey go home and lick their wounds.
And what happened to the Mandarin?
A one-page epilogue shows the Mandarin in a coma, recuperating in a hut in a rustic Chinese village with bandages over stumps that are where his hands used to be.
No! So there's going to be a story called The Hands of the Mandarin, I guess.
And Tony's really heartbroken over his, you know, one-hour love affair with the doctor.
That's the thing. He goes to visit, like, the husband then.
Well, right. I was going to say, to give him credit, that was a little... It wouldn't have worked. It would have really ruined the pacing to have elaborated more on that love plot thing, and it did end abruptly, and it did seem pretty superficial and everything. But after a John Romita Jr., Bob Wycheck, Iron Man pinup, we get an 8-page backup story written by Byrne, drawn by veteran Tony DeZuniga, that ties up the loose ends with Tony and Dr. Yin and shows more of those times in between them, and then shows Tony meeting the husband and coming to terms with all that and saying his goodbyes. And so at least they addressed it.
Yeah. And don't drive your car off a rocky cliff like Doctor Strange.
When you get excited that you're getting engagement. And you're getting
exactly.
I like how Byrne was so excited with himself in connecting those two origins that he went one step further and he made it be that the scientist who helped the Mandarin unlock the power of the rings was also the scientist who helped Tony in the cave build the first Iron Man armor.
Yeah, that's weird.
Funny. But I really enjoyed the storyline. It lived up to my expectations of going back and reading it as a good Fin Fang Foom story and a good Mandarin story. And I liked the Mandarin being so powerful, but really being a spectator the whole time of this thing happening around him, where it's just the dragons being all dragony. The scenes where the dragons revealed themselves and, you know, like a Chinese diplomat turns into a dragon all of a sudden, and the reaction of the staff all around them and all that. This was just a big scope, fun storyline that had the extra cherry on top of that continuity serving origin stuff. Worthy of issue 275.
And I think that sometimes I feel the tying together is overly forced, but I didn't feel that here. I felt like it was still a good story. Like, it wasn't like, I need to link these two. It was like, I have kind of a fun story, and it happens to link them. Sometimes I feel like they find some cool gap, and they're like, oh, we can link this. But this was really story-driven, I felt.
And you mean it wasn't like a Roy Thomas story?
Well, it actually... It didn't just tie those origins together, though. It actually enhanced them both, because we didn't know really where Fin Fang Foom came from, and we really didn't know where the spaceship that he got the rings from and everything, although we knew it was from a planet of dragon people, kind of came from, and this made it make sense. I thought that was cool.
But now you can visit Foom's, like, homeworld or something.
And well, try his delicious
whole
noodles.
Explanation for why they left is that, like, their planet was perfect with no war and no conflict, and they're bored. Like, we want to go mix it up. So these were the violent dragons. Like to see what was going on in the world and find out what was happening. Yeah, the only thing that would have been missing is if they unveiled a new armor at the end.
Right. Tony comes back in a new Chinese, like, samurai-styled armor for the final showdown.
Well, I do like this era, too. It was back when he had, like, a ton of different armors and would pull them out. And that's my favorite type of Iron Man. And, like, suits get junked and he pulls out the next one, or the underwater one, or the space one, or the one that's all covered in ash.
Right. I mean, this was only 10 years from the Shogun Warriors and that sort of stuff, and even a shorter amount of time from, like, Voltron cartoons, that I'm surprised that Byrne didn't actually go there and have a Asian-inspired style giant, you know, Fin Fang Foom Buster-type armor. It's amazing it would take until 2018 for Dan Slott to do it.
Yeah, it's kind of nuts.
Did you guys read the new Tony Stark Iron Man?
Yeah, relaunch? I had some relaunch. No, that isn't that issue 601? Is that the issue, Steve?
Sure it is. Sure it is, Kevin.
I have some thoughts. Here.
Where is it? Hold on, I'm paging through these. Singing Death in Humans.
The Tony Stark Iron Man. It's written by Dan Slott, art by Valerio Sheedy.
Is this Tony Stark Iron Man number one, legacy numbering 601?
Yes, 601.
That's the one.
601, yeah. I'm going to continue this gag, okay?
No, it's on the cover. It counts.
I know.
You can use the legacy numbering.
I just get a kick out of it.
Had to put that big number one on there to get me to buy it.
After having
that on random issues, just to get you to buy it.
After having just read the Dragon Seed arc, that Fin Fang Foom popped up in this issue was a real pleasure, and then to see, in fact, a Voltron-y Fin Fang Foom busting giant mech armor was pretty funny.
It was pretty neat. That was probably my highlight. It's weird though that it doesn't, like, the issue doesn't feel super modern.
Yeah, they spend a lot of time developing, setting up the new status quo and the new supporting cast of characters. So having something giant like Fin Fang Foom versus a big Fin Fang Foom Buster armor,
like,
I think
it's
thrown in there to give you that, to give you some of that breathing room to do the other stuff.
Yeah, it feels more Bronze Age than when Slott was doing Spider-Man.
I can tell you, the art does not feel Bronze Age to me at all.
Just about to say the same thing.
Yeah.
There are a lot of not only double page spreads, but double page layouts where the panels just go across the page the whole way, you know?
But
that was weird, was the choice for the artist. Is it, like, it's almost more organic. Like, everything's very rounded and soft edges,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to Tony, who I traditionally think the armor guys, you know, you go for a more edgy, mechanistic look. And this, to me, feels a lot more organic.
I was trying to figure out if that's just, like the story was, like, a classic Iron Man story, or if it was just, like, it really seemed to be recalling when they relaunched after Heroes Reborn.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm like, it's like those supporting characters, I'm like something happens at the company, I'm like, it's all those beats, which is fine. It's just seems like a bit of a tonal shift, and it's like, it's not, it doesn't have to be like real future thinking, but it's different.
Well, you've got Rhodey as part of the supporting cast. You've got familiar faces like Bethany Cab, the security whiz, although the controller has his discs into her. But also added in is Jocasta, who I know...
Yeah, I like that.
I know Slott liked her from his Mighty Avengers run, right? And this new engineer guy, Andy Bang, of Horizon Labs... wrong book. But he seems like the max... yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's not exactly that vibe, so that's good.
I mean, I'm supposed to be the texture and zip-a-tone guy, but it didn't come off quite. I think having, like I said, that sort of rounded artwork with the tones doesn't work for me as much. I don't know.
I hear you.
Because you'd think I'd be in heaven with all the, you know, everywhere has armor, the Fin Fang Foom busted armor, Fin Fang Foom himself, but I don't know, I think I prefer more the kind of, like we just saw, the sort of texture showing almost, not really scales, but like ridges and contours, and this feels like just an overall generic kind of almost rubber monster suit in a way.
Agreed, actually. Although what stood out to me more was that I wasn't appreciating the artists. I mean, with all this focus on the interactions between the characters and trying to develop the cast, it was the quiet moments that felt boring to me, visually. Whereas I thought that could have been spiced up a little bit. But, you know, they tried to do the things of, like, you know, Jocasta can't fit in and...
But the cliffhanger on the second issue, Steve.
Grumpy Machine Man?
Yeah, Mr. Stack.
Do we think the colorist is... The colorist must be the one putting in all that tone. I wonder if the artist tells them or gives them suggestions. Because it has to be like a Photoshop filter or whatever, right? With all that stuff?
Yeah, I would think so. In today's day and age.
Yeah, it's weird also with Jocasta being, like I said, with all those soft edges and everything. Although her metal hair really looks a lot more like hair, I will say.
Now, contrast
the overuse of textures and everything in the comic. It's a fun, like, the storytelling is great and everything. Don't let my weird picadillos on texture turn anyone off of this.
No, listeners have gotten used. Listeners have gotten used to your curmudgeonly analysis of the books.
Andy, the guy who doesn't like comics, who reads a lot of comics.
He reads a lot of number ones.
Well, speaking of Slott, what about the book he left? Did you guys read the first Spider-Man? A couple of Spider-Man books?
Yes.
Yeah.
Wait, these different titles?
Written by Nick Spencer with art by Ryan Ottley.
I've been really looking forward to this one.
Amazing Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Is that the one?
Yep.
With the wraparound cover?
Now, it's funny, we were just talking about colorists. The colors in this book pop like I'm not sure any other Marvel book that I've seen in a while. But at the same time, I'm not sure if I like it or not. It's very it's very bubblegummy to me, but the colors are very vibrant. So part of me likes it, and part of me is not sure yet.
I like it. I actually like the art and the quiet, non-costume scenes.
Agreed.
Better than I like it when everyone's in costume, which is weird. Like, agreed. I much prefer, as you were calling them before, the quiet moments. And when they have the big action set pieces. And I don't know if that's the colors with Ottley or the colorists alone or Ottley together with the colorist or how that works.
I had a slight problem with the art with a particular character in the first issue that I don't know if I was able to distract myself with or didn't notice it in the second issue, but in the first issue, sometimes I kept on seeing a certain Invincible character when Mary Jane showed up.
Sure. Absolutely. I think that's in some ways no surprise. But all right, so that's the Ottley Invincible angle, but with the Spencer angle, Spencer's baggage, there's good and bad to it. On one hand, I'm like, Spencer's writing Amazing Spider-Man. Hey, that's cool. I loved his Superior Foes, right? We unapologetically loved that series, all of us.
Yeah.
And well, his handling of those villains and everything and those street-level characters, that should this be perfect? But then I'm looking at Spencer and I'm saying, but he just did that Cap thing that I really didn't like. So we'll see.
He had enough great books that he's done. And, like, enough books with, like, Spider-Man villains and all that stuff where I was, like, completely comfortable. I'm like, that, I wasn't like, oh, now Spider-Man's gonna, I don't know, whatever some crazy plot is. Like, I didn't think he was gonna bring that to Spider-Man, and he didn't. And I think the second issue's even better than the first issue.
I like the return of, like, Peter Parker having a lot of problems all around. Like, it's nice to set that up right away and be like, okay, we're going back to he's not going to be a millionaire or win the world and everything. He's going to be the level
of it was a bit abrupt, though, wasn't it? I mean, and severe. Like, it just all sort of boom.
I kind of feel like that had the ball had started rolling on that in at the end of Slott's. So it wasn't like a big change. I don't know. And it was it's drawing from those storylines too.
Like they really like. I mean, he's completely out at like done. You know, even Aunt May turns on him, which seems like a strong. Like that's rarely done, out the gate.
If you would have done that some other way, I probably would have been like it wouldn't have seemed like a good idea. But I'm like, no, this just builds on what was already there and pulling at other strings. And I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. But I don't know how he would get out of it. Or maybe that's why we have the other storyline where another character shows up again.
I mean, part of, and this is, again, my own weird mental illness, that the one thing I don't like that Spencer's going to do, but while I loved it in Superior Foes, I don't really want to see him make jokers and losers out of the classic Spidey's Rogues Gallery, like Mysterio and everything. I like those as good characters, not as like, oh, hey, we're going to turn them into Scorpion, or we're going to turn him into Herman, who's going to like be afraid of everything.
I thought you were going to say you were a big fan of The Ringer, and you're like, I can't believe he disrespected The Ringer. And I was going to be like, you're thinking, a big Ringer guy?
I thought it was...
But the Mysterio, he makes him into, like, just a joke. And I'm not a big fan of... Like, I like Mysterio. Like, that's a character.
I thought it was cool to see Mysterio again, at least.
Yeah. I kind of thought, like, it was his usual, making people believe all these types of things. Like, there's aliens or whatever. I'm like, yeah, that's typical Mysterio.
And it was cool to have an action sequence associated where Otley could draw all the different Marvel heroes, right, fighting Mysterio's illusions.
Yes, and I like that. I feel like the courtroom scene. He's going to make Mysterio the butt of the joke and just a goofy guy. And that works with some, but I don't want every single... We have Boomerang for that. We have Hermit. Like, we already have enough of those. So if you do that to every villain, I feel like... I don't know. But that's my own... I like those classic... Ditko villains.
The
punchlines isn't really where I want the book to go.
But, seeing him doing that to all his major bad guys, like, sometimes I'm concerned about the devaluing of villains, but I think I would have to see a lot more issues.
Yeah, that's different. Your classic villains are different from mine.
Well, that's the thing.
I'm into Mysterio. You're into Cardiac.
Yeah.
You know, we're just different eras.
Your villains deserve to be disrespected, Kevin.
What?
Is what Andrew's trying to say.
Mysterio or Ditko. What?
No, I love Mysterio. No. I thought it was cool to see. That's where I thought it was like, all right, it might not be the coolest presentation of Mysterio, but he's drawn well. It was cool to see Otley's Mysterio. And it was cool to see the superior foe characters be brought in. Speaking of the lovable loser villains, having Boomerang be part of the book is going to be interesting. Having the Beetle, the Tombstone's daughter Beetle, involved is good. Peter and MJ together again is cool.
The thing I'm most concerned about, because we wasted time towards the end of the slot run where he did all this stuff based off of a story that was, like, already told. It's like we've already been over this ground, so it just feels like he was wasting time, wasting pages on stuff that wasn't going to happen. And I feel like I don't really want to see a story where a writer is just trolling the audience for the 10th time on Mary Jane. Like,
I know.
Like, you either do it or you don't do it.
But Otley... You said it before. He's got to draw the redhead.
Is true.
When she's smiling at him, it becomes... It's an inside joke. It becomes invincible and... What's her face?
I know. I didn't have as much trouble in the second issue, and I don't know why. So it's sort of going to be a thing I'm going to have to keep my eye on.
Although I have to say, Kevin, based on what I saw, I think they are doing it. I mean, you know, they're together.
And she knows.
Well, that's what
again?
I'm thinking. Maybe this is just an elaborate thing where they'd be like, we weren't really going for that. And then I'll be like, well, you just wasted all those pages then. So I don't know. We'll see. It seems like they wouldn't even consider it before. So that's why I'm still hesitant right now to see that they're actually going to do it. So I don't know.
And how do you gentlemen feel about the size inflation of a lot of these characters? Like, Lizard now is like 15 feet tall and everything.
Yeah, I've gotten over my different artists not maintaining, like, not drawing the characters on model. It doesn't exist anymore. One issue, you know, the guy looks one way, one issue the guy looks the other way. It's just going to... Different artists, different interpretations, and I think I've gotten to the point now where I actually don't mind it. You know, it's like, all right, let's see what Otley's Lizard looks like.
I guess I just feel, I don't know, I'm I guess because of the recent passing, I feel more like bummed out about some of the things.
I think it only bugs me when it gets to an insane level. Like, I always think of that Venom in that Thunderbolts issue where his like muscles had muscles and he's taking up the whole page and I'm like, okay. But usually it's, you know, just an artistic interpretation, stylistic thing.
It is, but I was thinking how that, I don't know, I just feel like that's done with a lot of characters. And what was interesting about the original lizard design was he was more lithe and compact, but still scaly and lizardy, as opposed to, like, this could be Venom, this could be Stegron, this could be any of those.
Yeah, but the lizard doesn't even have the same snout and everything that he did back then anyways.
Yeah, that cute little snout.
It's like looking at Rogue or someone. It's like they don't even have the same face anymore.
No. Well, it also feels, I guess the other problem is it feels too much like the Distinguished Competition as like Killer Croc and those ones.
Right.
And I feel like they've gone down that road and they've plumbed that. And I was happy to give them that versus a different, the lizard looks different.
Like if Black Cat starts being 10 feet tall, then I'm going to have a problem.
Yeah. Well, Marvel needs their Giganta, I guess. No. We've got our Killer Croc now. Now we need a Giganta.
Actually, maybe it'd be pretty cool if Black Cat was 10 feet tall.
Did you guys read any of the ending of the Infinity Countdown stuff?
I read Countdown and Prime. Not that Prime.
Did you read any of the tie-in books that they had? They had a few, like, one-shots. A couple of them were, like, two-shots. Or they had, like, Infinity Countdown Captain Marvel, Infinity Countdown Daredevil, Infinity Countdown Black Widow, Infinity Countdown Champions.
I have the Black Widow one.
And Infinity Countdown, most importantly, Darkhawk.
No, I didn't, but I feel like I should have picked up Champions and Darkhawk now.
The Champions one was fluff. Really what it was for most of the issues is it's let's touch upon some of the characters who have a gem and see like why they have it, how they have it, what they're doing with it kind of thing. So the Daredevil one is all about Turk, right? Because he's got one of the gems. And the Captain Marvel one is about how she ended up with the gem. The Black Widow one, she's got the gem from Wolverine. And the Champions one is about them fighting Thanos.
But I think the Champion ones had some developments for its own title, which I'm now reading. So that's why I was like, oh, maybe I should have read that.
Yeah, with the Nova not being Nova anymore, Sam Nova, and some other stuff is going on in there, yeah. But the Infinity Countdown Darkhawk book, that you need to read, Kevin. That was... The creative team was, there was two writers, but it's not Abnett and Lanning. It's Chris Sims and Chad Bowers.
From that issue, was it 51?
Exactly. No. Exactly. Yeah. This follows up on that. And the artist is Gang Hike Lim. And what they're doing here is fixing Darkhawk, Kevin. They are not thumbing their nose at all of this Raptors, Shi'ar, Celestial stuff that's involved, but they are getting Darkhawk back to being Chris and Darkhawk just the way you like them, but with a little more control, a little few new gadgets and tricks up his sleeve kind of thing. And it continues on the whole Robbie Ryder as one of the Talons and Nova confronting Robbie Ryder and the Talons being basically wiped out, Robbie Ryder becoming this dark Starhawk and getting all celestial and everything. And at the very end, without spoiling anything, Chris does get his amulet back and is like Darkhawk proper. But along the way, we get to see him like a giant sized Darkhawk, like flying through starships and stuff.
So it's not like Overhawk.
But at the end, it's still, I mean, you've got Chris Powell. He's on the Code Blue police force now. So you still have him tied into something that can, you know, that's still earthbound and can generate future stories. He's got the Darkhawk powers. And I will spoil this because it'll make you want to read the book. On the last panel, Chris Powell wakes up from his sleep and he's being visited by Sleepwalker. And the Sleepwalker is saying, it's not enough that you've regained the amulet. Now you must also become a Sleepwalker.
What?
Swear to God. Very cool. You should check it out. The Infinity Countdown Darkhawk 4-issue limited series. If you like the Darkhawk stuff and you want to see, and you got totally turned off by the Celestials, you know, DNA stuff that they were doing, this is interesting because it brings it back. It bottlenecks everything. It doesn't take it, it doesn't ignore it. It uses it and it moves forward in a way that I found satisfying.
Cool.
I picked up the Black Widow one, Steve. I like Brent Schulenberger.
Yeah.
But it's weird. It was him and Nick Varela, so the art felt, I don't know, like in different times, Black Widow looks a lot different.
Agreed.
I don't know. And that was weird. Like, I don't mind that she looks different, but in the same issue, it's like, whoa. I guess we didn't know who did this panel.
That whole Infinity.
It's fun.
Yeah, I mean, that whole Infinity Countdown series itself is really just about establishing that the gems are back and putting them in certain people's hands so that the stage is set for this, what is it, Infinity Wars thing that's happening?
Yeah, where Thanos gets all the gems again and conquers the universe.
We'll see. There's this other Gamora-like character running around with her sword trying to collect them, too. So we'll see what happens when their paths meet. But of those Infinity Countdown tie-ins, I would say that the Darkhawk one is the one that addresses the story that you were reading in Infinity Countdown the most.
And it looks like there were four of them.
Yep. 5 issues of Infinity Countdown, 4 issues of the Darkhawk tie-in.
Dang, that's like a major...
Oh, dude, something had to be done. Something had to be done for to fix that character.
I like your something has to be done. You've had enough as you can. I also read, I don't know if you guys picked up, but I read them in the wrong order, the Rising and Rising Alpha. These are the new, I guess, to help launch the cartoon.
Yeah, I definitely picked this up.
Squirrel Girl and Miss Marvel, and then Rising Alpha. So I read Rising Squirrel Girl and Miss Marvel first, even though it's a two on the cover. I was like, this is great. I like that it just jumped in the middle of the story.
Well, doesn't that happen?
When I read Rising Alpha, I was like, oh, this is the part one. I'm less impressed with their, like, just throwing stuff in. But I thought they were both fun issues.
Rising sort of starts like that too, though, because I was like, well, does this happen in, like, the Zero issue? Like, there's some preamble to some of the stuff, or, like, I didn't know if that had already taken place, or they were just, you know, just quickly going over a few things to get the story started. So, it's funny that I sort of have the same reaction, but I read Alpha first.
Yeah, I like just being thrown into stories and... You know, this is a book pitched at small children. I think we can figure it.
No, this is a book pitched at me. New readers, old readers, me readers.
Georges Duarte, Rachel Rosenberg on the first one. So the first one, it sets up who the villain is. And she's not really a real villain. She's just misunderstood. And her ability is to, like, pop characters out of video games into real world. Like from Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. Remember that character?
I do.
Well, this is like the girl version of that. Except she's not in the game. She just pulls the characters out.
Isn't this kind of like the monster drawing kid?
Yeah, except it's a lot more fun. And less like ominous and scary because, you know, they're in this coding class together and they're just laughing it up and... You know, Miss Marvel, Squirrel Girl, and weird video game creatures, when you destroy them, they turn into pixels, lends itself to less overt drama and more just people having fun. And so, but there's still destruction and mayhem. Yeah. But it felt like they were the right bad guys, and it lets like the team kind of expand. So did you pick up Marvel Rising too, Kevin? That was like the huge one.
Yeah, I picked up the Alpha, and then I have the rest of the issues to read still. So,
because I liked what they, even though Marvel Rising's part two, they had a different name, so it could be a number one issue.
Yeah, like I know one Squirrel Girl, Miss Marvel, and the other one's Miss Marvel Squirrel Girl.
Yeah,
and then they're so supposed to be one, in an Omega.
And then Rising, they add Ryan North is also along with G. Willow Wilson and Devin Grayson again, but those two are the new ones, and so they switch the art teams up depending on who's writing it. So the beginning starts with Squirrel Girl. I'd forgotten. I need to jump on Unlimited and read some of that. I forgot they did all those footnotes and everything, and when they're doing Squirrel Girl, just silly jokes and all that stuff. And who doesn't like more content, you know? In fact, I think that's one of the footnotes. So basically, they're teaming up on these on the new bad guy, but they're trying to be smart about it. And Miss America Chavez, she's Miss America, right? America Chavez?
Yeah, she's America.
Is that her? Is her name just America, or is it what's her superhero name?
It's just America.
Okay, so America shows up. It just seems weird to say that,
right?
Like not Captain, not Miss, not Best America, not Fighting American, but America shows up.
She's not American Dream.
There you go. There's another one, and then Inferno shows up. Yeah. So it's just all the heroes trying. And then but clearly I did not get the last part because it doesn't end.
That's no. It's funny, though. They're at the same school. So they're like the same same heroes. Squirrel Girl and Miss Marvel keep on teaming up. But they're both going to the same thing and doing the same stuff. But you have a secret ID and everything, so you're like, I have to go to that place right now. But it's going to be pretty obvious that they're going to figure out that one of them is a teacher, one of them is a student. Oh, good times.
Well, that's the bell. We'll retire to our corners for this episode and come out swinging again next time around. Hope you enjoyed what we served up this time. You can reach us on our Facebook page or on Twitter at Marvel Noise. Next episode, I'll have my con report from the 2018 Boston Comic Con, and we'll find out what Kevin, Andrew, and I have been reading. Until Tony Stark becomes iron deficient, make mine Marvel. Later.